15th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. More information is available at 333-6280.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning as we go into our second hour. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls today. This morning, in this part of Focus, we will be talking a bit about Tennessee Williams, the great American playwright, and also a little bit about theater and what was going on in the American theater in the 1930s. Tennessee Williams, no doubt, will be best known to people who are listening for plays like Glass Menagerie and Streetcar Named Desire and perhaps also Rose Tattoo and Night of the Iguana. He certainly was very greatly honored in his time, won the Pulitzer Prize 2 times, won a couple of New York Drama Critics Circle Awards, won a Tony Award. And those plays, the best-known plays, certainly have been performed many times. They have been made into films. This point, however, here people in and around Champaign-Urbana have the opportunity to see a very early work of Tennessee Williams. In fact, his first full-length play that was first produced in 1937. The title of the play is Candles to the Sun, and it's being performed now on the University of Illinois campus. And folks here in the theater department are spending time thinking about talking about Tennessee Williams. And that is what we will do here in this hour of the show with two guests. Christopher Bigsby is professor of American Studies. He's also director of the Arthur Miller Center at University of East Anglia in England. Also here with us is Tom Mitchell. He's associate professor of theater at University of Illinois. And as we talk, of course, if there are folks who are listening who have questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And at any point here, people want to join the conversation, they certainly may. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here.
We appreciate it. Perhaps we talk just a little bit at the beginning here about Tennessee Williams and perhaps also what was happening in his life at this particular time, certainly before everyone knew who Tennessee Williams was. I guess having just read a little bit about him, this was at a time when he was of university age or had been in university, had gone to university at least at one point intending to be a journalist, had written poetry, and I guess wrote poetry throughout his life, but really hadn't thought about being a dramatist, and in fact hadn't really, when he wrote this particular play, hadn't been writing plays very long, not long at all. How did he go from thinking that he might be a journalist or to thinking that he would be a poet or might be a poet to thinking that he might indeed be a playwright?
Well, I think in large part, this was during the 1930s and the Great Depression, and so money was hard to be had. And Williams was working and trying to make some money. He was living still with his parents, and his father was eager for him to earn a living for himself. And so a lot of what motivated him was to make money. And so he would submit his poems, his short stories, and some short dramatic works with the hope of getting them published or to win cash awards for those things. And I think that's really what motivated these first plays.
Mm. Just that he needed the money.
Right. Mm.
And I think, above all, he wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And he didn't particularly mind right at the beginning what it was going to be. I mean, he had a short story published, a very gothic sort of short story. He would try his hand at anything. So I don't think he was born with the desire to be a playwright. That's the direction his career took.
Hmm. And this particular play has very clear political themes. This is a play, and I, one or both of you can just give a at some point give a brief synopsis of the play here. But basically, it's a play. It's set in a coal mining camp in Alabama, and it involves a strike. I mean, it involves, you know, the dramatic themes are the terrible hardships that the workers have to endure living in a company town where that's the only thing to do, and everybody's just kind of scratching a living out of the earth. And the thing everybody is talking about is this all there is to life? Will things ever be any better? What can we do to make things better? And it's very, you know, much about the plight of people who are poor working people. So clearly it's got all these political themes. Is that what Tennessee Williams really set out to do? I mean, did he have this idea that I want to write a play about the plight of the working man.
I think he was writing in a decade in which that was the kind of play that was being written. He was being formed as a writer and was fully aware of what was going on in the American theater. He was writing this play in the mid-1930s. And I think it's necessary to get your mind back then to realize why he would do this thing. After all, 1935, one of the most popular plays was Awake and Sing, another one called Waiting for Lefty by Clifford Odets, produced by the Group Theatre in New York, an amazingly powerful and influential theatre. A young Arthur Miller used to sit entranced in the audience watching these plays. They were about strikes. They were about people without jobs, because that was the situation in America. The federal government set up the federal theatre. That takes a bit of understanding today, doesn't it? That they would actually invest money. The federal theatre wasn't a building. It was an organization that existed across America. You could open a play in 26 theaters across the country. It's like opening a movie. And it only lasted for about 5 years, but in that time it produced socially and politically aware drama and had audiences equivalent to a quarter of the population of the United States, because you could get in for 10 cents. It's not that people in America, you know, fought to get into theatres before, but there was a new theatre. It was a theatre that related to their lives as they saw them in that decade, and that didn't put up financial barriers for getting into them. And there were lots of radical theatre groups across America, not just in New York, where perhaps you would have expected them, but elsewhere, including St. Louis, where Tennessee Williams found himself.
Hmm. Right. And at that time, he was a working man himself. He'd been working in the International Shoe Company warehouse, detailing the comings and goings of boxes of shoes, and was paid a minimum wage. And so I think he did identify with those working men and women, and identified in some way with the workers in the coal camps.
At exactly the same time, Arthur Miller was working in an automobile parts warehouse in New York, exactly where Lincoln Center is today. They abolished, knocked down that building in order to build Lincoln Center. He was there for 2 years, earning enough money to get to university. And then when you got to university, universities were very radical. It was easier, someone said, to join the Communist Party than a fraternity in those days. The Communist Party, the United States, you know, what world are we in?
One of the things that I read about the play is that it was somebody else's play to start out with. Someone else, or there's this idea that another writer wrote a one-act play dealing with, at least was set in the coal mining camp, and that somehow that was passed on to Tennessee Williams. The other author said, "Here, you know, I'm not really sure what I'm doing with this. I'm not completely here. Take the play. Do what you want with it. See what you can do with this." And that then Tennessee Williams took that and, of course, made something much more out of it. But that, I guess, that it just goes back to this question: would Tennessee Williams have sat down and thought about writing that play if he was just starting from a blank page and starting himself? Or was the direction somewhat set by the fact that there was another story, there were some other characters that he inherited?
In some ways, yes. He had written a short play for the same group, a group called the Mummers of St. Louis, which was a little theater group that were interested in this kind of political performance.
This is not the Mummers and the Poppers. This is
M-U-M-M-E-R-S.
And for the Mummers, he had written a play about students on the Washington University campus who had protested the ROTC, the military training on that campus. Mm-hmm. So he was already in a political vein with this short piece he'd written there. And then they asked him to come back and write did he have anything else, a full-length play? And he had this short work that he had sort of taken over from a friend of his grandfather's who was from the South. And it was by chance, I think, that he took that over. He had never been to Alabama. I don't think he'd ever been to a coal mine. So that part of the play was a bit invented by him. He writes in some of his letters about his intention to come over to southern Illinois across the river from St. Louis and visit some of the Illinois coal mines. But I don't know that he ever did that. Yes, I think he did have a political bent, and as Chris said, the theater of the time tended to be political in this way. But he took advantage of what was there and made the most of it and filled out the short play.
The reason he wrote that play, that piece about ROTC, is that he had himself flunked ROTC
which
course.
Made his father very unhappy. And his father said, well, in that case, you're not going back there.
Exactly. He pulled him out and he had to work in the shoe store, in the shoe warehouse, which, of course, was going to feature in the Glass Menagerie. And they were in St. Louis. You can still see the apartment, which is featured in the Glass Menagerie. So there are personal dimensions to these plays. But another play that he wrote at the time was a play about set in a prison and about the appalling conditions that existed in a prison. Well, I hate to sound obsessed with Arthur Miller, but he wrote a play set in a prison and about the appalling conditions at the time as well. And Miller actually knew something about it because his friend was a psychiatrist working in that prison. He went to visit it, as opposed to Tennessee Williams. These plays, you know, were scarcely known, but that Tennessee Williams prison play, not about nightingales, was read in the University of Texas archive, the Harry Ransom Center, by an actress, Vanessa Redgrave, who thought it could be staged. And because it was Vanessa Redgrave, she went back to England and persuaded Britain's National Theatre to do it and her own brother to play the principal part. And it was an astonishing production. I would never have guessed it. It's extraordinarily melodramatic, but it was a brilliant production. And that play of the 30s suddenly came alive.
Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus. Christopher Bigsby is professor of American Studies and director of the Arthur Miller Center at University of East Anglia in England. Tom Mitchell is associate professor of theater at University of Illinois. We're talking here about Tennessee Williams and particularly about an early play of Williams, Candles to the Sun, which is now being produced on the U of I campus, opened last week. Is that right?
Right.
And there are yet more performances this coming
performances through
weekend.
Sunday this week.
So it is, there are still tickets as possible for people
yes.
who are listening to us to go see the play. Also, maybe I mentioned too that one of our guests here, Christopher Bigsby, will be giving a talk about Tennessee Williams, Radical of the Heart, and that's tomorrow afternoon, 2 p.m. in the Studio Theater. And I'm assuming that anybody who would want to come by and hear it should feel welcome.
Absolutely.
All right. And questions welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you can talk a little bit, one or both of you, talk a little bit about the basic story of the play, Candles to the Sun.
Well, Candles to the Sun is set in this coal mining camp in Alabama. The family has three children, two boys and a 16-year-old daughter. The oldest son has moved away from home, and they find out very soon that he's been killed in a mining accident in Pennsylvania. And the daughter is running away from home to live an illicit sort of life with a man, with one of the coal miners. And so the conflicts are set up in the beginning in that way. And it follows through then what happens to this family as they all grow older. The daughter grows into a woman, and the younger son also becomes of the age to go into the coal mines. And it's a fairly typical story of what happens in those coal mining families, is that individuals die in the mines. And it seems that it was so ordinary an act that you find plays like this quite often in the time, and the songs of Woody Guthrie. There are a number of plays about coal mining accidents and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's the premise of the play.
Yeah, the men are fated to go down the mines, though of course it's exactly what their mothers want them not to do. They are not to go the way their fathers had gone. Too many people have died. It's too precarious a profession. But what were you to do in the 30s? There was very little work going. And so each generation follows the others with the disasters that occur. The women, meanwhile, tend to get are pushed into prostitution. And into this scene suddenly comes a radical agitator and the unions, which is, again, a very 1930s motif that's there. So there is a savior, but it's a secular savior. So it's Marxist, although the Marxism isn't pushed very, very hard. This doesn't seem to, you know, sound like a very attractive play. And certainly Williams himself later was tended to disparage it. He thought that in many ways it was not a good play. In many ways it it's not a good play, but there are aspects to it which are really quite surprising. And I have not seen it, so I'm looking forward to seeing it. I know it off the page, but that's not the same thing at all.
Yeah. And I guess it's is it correct? Do I have this correct that this play was actually not even published until quite recently?
Yes, just last fall it was published. Many of these plays, these early plays, were withheld from publication for a number of years, and only recently have they become available, and then scholars have picked them up and edited them, sometimes taking several different versions in order to put the plays together into a readable form.
You have to say that by all accounts, it was amazingly successful when it was put on in St. Louis by the Mummers. He recalls people standing up and applauding and cheering it. But when he submitted it to a national organization and it went out to professional readers, they were somewhat jaundiced in their response to it.
Was this play produced beyond that initial production in 1937? So that production there, St. Louis by the Mummers, 1937, until now? This is no one has done this play?
That's right. That's right. So this is the 21st, we refer to this as the 21st century premiere because the play has been done, but not for many years.
Yeah. With a play, and I suppose you'd ask this question, you could ask this question of any writer, when you look at their very early work, you could understand that it would be of academic interest to people who, in this case, for example, for people who study the life and work of Tennessee Williams or for people who are interested in the history of American theater. But past that kind of, and I think that's a relatively small, relatively small audience, past that, and do you think this work really has interest for a more general audience?
Yes, I'd say so. From my experience with this play and with the other early plays, Williams' sense of character, creating character for one thing, is so strong that he creates a number of very compelling characters in this play. The star, who's the prostitute, prefigures the Blanche DuBois sort of character in later works. But she's a very interesting woman. She's conflicted in her feelings and the choices she's made in her life. And this Birmingham Red character, who's the labor organizer, is a very charismatic figure on the page and in performance. So the plays work surprisingly well, I think. And it's because of his sense not just of playwriting and creating a story, but especially of creating characters and the dynamic interaction between characters.
Mm-hmm. And I think people believe they've got a handle on Miller and Williams. They both appeared after the Second World War. Glass Menagerie, 1945. All My Sons by Miller, 1947. They were a post-Second World War phenomenon. But in fact, both of them had been writing for a good decade before that. And I think when you go back to those works and then go on and read those later works or see those later works, it has a different coloration. You realize there is something else going on here, which then goes under the surface, but is still there. This business of Williams's radicalism. If you just saw the plays of the 1930s, you would think of him as a radical political playwright. If you knew the Tennessee Williams that we do all know from 45 onwards, that probably wouldn't cross your mind too much. Mm-hmm. But it's there in the plays. It's there in a lot of the plays, just below the surface. It takes a new form now. So I think rediscovering these works and getting them out there so that people can see them has an effect on how you see their careers as a whole.
Let's talk with caller here. Someone here locally, Champaign County, line one.
Hello. Hi, I tried not to call but as a regular caller, but I just was so intrigued by this whole thing. I'd like to hear more about this troupe, the Mummers. I think it takes a British fellow to explain why they picked the name and the milieu of that time. I'm very intrigued also by the short play that you didn't give a name to, the anti-ROTC play. I wonder if there's any way to find that and find out the story of that, because for one thing, I'm intrigued because the Washington University campus rose up and burned down the ROTC building during the Vietnam era. And then the transformation that you're kind of referring to, that he was not, it's probably more the critics that not perceiving the the political dimension, but I'm sure there was also something related to his sort of, I don't know, in a sense, I think he's sort of ostracism is probably too strong of a word. He was well regarded, but in his time, but getting out of St. Louis in the sense of not being able to be out in St. Louis and going down the river to New Orleans, I'm sure someone was going to call with that, so maybe I'll start that, and I'll just hang up and listen if you would.
Okay. Thanks for the questions. All of that you want to talk about?
I don't think we do know the title.
Called Headlines.
Oh,
that
right.
Short play was called Headlines, and it doesn't seem – I've not heard of anyone who has a copy of that play. I don't know if it exists. It was only a 10-minute play, and we know the characters in it from the program, but we don't know exactly what the story was.
Was that reference to out, meaning his gayness?
I assume so.
Yes. I mean, he was 28 before he had a male relationship. He tussled with his sexual identity. And it's not hard to see why Tennessee Williams' plays celebrate those people who are pushed to the margin of society, who feel themselves oppressed, threatened, as his characters tend to do. You tend to forget how vicious the laws were in the United States with respect to homosexuality until really comparatively recent days, very recent days in certain states. And I wouldn't want to go back and just read Tennessee Williams in those terms. I'm not saying he was Blanche Dubois, although there's an element of him in Blanche. But that is crucial to him. And he was admirer of other writers who wrestled with the same situation, the same sensibility, the same sexuality. Hart Crane, for example, was one of his great, great heroes. He felt the same kind of anguish.
I think one of the things that makes these early works potent is that he was still wrestling with his sexual identity at that time. I don't think that he was quite clear about his orientation, and it comes through in the conflicts between characters. This play has a very passionate love scene between these two characters, and it's surprising how effectively he writes that scene.
Since I mentioned St. Louis, we ought to say, in case there's anyone from St. Louis listening, he hated and detested St. Louis and his time there. He went to the University of Missouri at Columbia first, then the ROTC incident, dropped out, went back to WashU, Washington University in St. Louis, where he wrote these plays. And this was absolutely crucial as a launch pad for him. And then he went on to the University of Iowa. So, in fact, St. Louis was a passing phase, but he detested it. He didn't like the apartment they lived in. He found everything very oppressive, apart from some of the courses that he went to, because he was exposed to playwriting courses, as was Eugene O'Neill, as was Arthur Miller.
He was also exposed to some very political thinkers in St. Louis. St. Louis was probably like most other major cities at the time, there was a lot of political activity, especially this sort of union activity. He was a friend of a man named Jack Conroy, who was a writer who wrote a major book novel of the Depression era. And it seems clear that Williams was affected by what Conroy wrote, models some of his characters, some of the action on elements in Conroy's book, The Disinherited. But they would go to the bars down by the river during this time, and I'm sure share ideas about politics and a few drinks as well.
Williams always thought of himself as a revolutionary. That was his self-image. The question is how deep that went and how real that revolutionary spirit was. I mean, there's a late play that he wrote, Red Devil Battery Sign, which is an out-and-out attack on American capitalism, kind of withering attack on American capitalism. Arthur Miller said of him, there is a radicalism of the soul, and I think that's what he thought Williams' radicalism consisted of, not a coherent political ideological position. He never really had that. He couldn't sort it out. He sort of limped along behind the times. The Spanish Civil War, which electrified a generation of students at university, 1936, seven, and so on. Miller nearly went to it, thanked his mother for stopping him going eventually. That at first meant nothing to Williams. Then later he sort of registered its existence, but it just slipped him by. He was not a political radical, but he was at odds with a great deal that America seemed to stand for. Materialism, power, these things actually frightened him, and they were inimical to his sensibility and his way of life.
Well, you were talking earlier about the fact that if all you knew of Tennessee Williams was some of these very early works, you would think, well, this was a politically very radical. This was a radical playwright, a radical polish. But then if you look at the plays that now we really know him for, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and Glass Menagerie and Streetcar Named Desire, you know, those plays, they don't, at least on the broad surface of it, they don't seem to be particularly political works. But I'm interested, the caller sort of raised this issue. Well, are there, if you really look close at some of those really well-known works, the ones that we know him for, do you in fact see political themes there that are there? Yes, if you do.
I mean, the rich do not come off well in Tennessee Williams' plays, in Orpheus Descending, for example. Virtually none of his plays to the rich, they tend to be given Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Big Daddy, and that sort of know-nothing wealthy family. He's rotting away with cancer. And I don't think he's simply talking about that character. He's thinking of what that character represents and stands for. So, yes, it does continue in that way. But what he celebrates is the poet living in a prosaic world, the subtle, gentle soul, the poetic sensibility, trying to operate in a world that seems to understand nothing of that. And your caller also touched on something very interesting, which is he hinted at a relative disregard, ultimately, of Tennessee Williams. And in that sense, he shares a great deal with other American playwrights. America has a hard time in acknowledging just how good its drama is. Miller lived the last 30 years of his life pretty well disregarded or attacked by American critics while celebrated in the rest of the world. The last decade and more of Tennessee Williams' life, he was written off. He did go through what he called his stoned decade in the 1960s, which was he was high on drugs, drink, and the Catholic Church for a while as well. But there was a recovery, which I don't think was acknowledged here. There's something terribly concerned with fashion in America. Tennessee Williams, yes, he was 40s, 50s. That was then. Arthur Miller, Death of a Salesman, Crucible, it's stuff. They don't know anything about the plays of the last 20, 30 years. It always baffled me why that should be so, because in Europe, they were always waiting for the last bit. I can remember what it was like waiting for the new Tennessee Williams, the shock of suddenly last summer. Something that could never have been written by a British writer. The sheer excitement he generated, I never quite saw replicated in his own country.
Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. Christopher Bigsby is professor of American Studies and director of the Arthur Miller Center at University of East Anglia in England. Tom Mitchell is associate professor of theater at University of Illinois. We're talking about Tennessee Williams, particularly because right at the moment, folks here on this campus in the theater department are talking about Tennessee Williams. And one of the things that's going on is a production of a very early play, his first full-length play, Candles to the Sun, that was produced, as we have heard here, by an amateur theater group, 1937 in St. Louis, and apparently, as far as anybody knows, is now being produced for the first time since here on the U of I campus. There will be some performances this weekend, so if you'd like to see the play, you can do that. Also, one of our guests here, Christopher Bigsby, will be talking about Tennessee Williams. He'll be giving a talk, Tennessee Williams, Radical of the Heart, tomorrow, 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the Studio Theater on the U of I campus. So if you're interested, you can stop by. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess one of the things that people, one of the few things probably that people would know about Tennessee Williams is that his plays certainly are in many ways autobiographical. His experiences, his life experience, end up being in those plays, and that particularly women characters often are a reflection of his sister. And so Blanche DuBois may indeed be in some part Tennessee Williams, but a part is also is his own sister. Do you see? I'm interested in, again, going back to Candles to the Sun. When you look at the women characters here, do you see that same kind of thing, where the women he knew, the women that would have been important to him in his life, they end up informing the women characters in the play.
I think to some degree. It isn't – I don't find it's quite as simple as saying that one character is equivalent to another. But you see threads of all those people in his life and aspects of his life woven through several characters. And there are elements of this prostitute character that I think relate to his sister. The mother, there is a mother and father of the mining family, the coal mining family. And the conflicts in that household between mother and father are very reminiscent of the reading the diaries of Tennessee's mother, Edwina Williams, and the conflicts she had with her husband. So, yes, I think you see his life on stage in ways.
Well, his sister Rose was mentally damaged and had one of the early prefrontal lobotomy operations. And Williams never really forgave himself. He wasn't there when the decision was made by his mother to have this operation carried out. And thereafter, she was effectively confined to a mental institution. And he would look after her. He would take her out to New York for decades afterwards. He left the proceeds from some of his work to look after her. You'll find an image of her in the Glass Menagerie. In the Glass Menagerie, the young girl is not mentally damaged. She has a damaged foot, which becomes the image of it. And she lives inside a world of her glass animals. Mm-hmm. She steps briefly outside when it looks as though she may be lured out into life. But the cruelty of it is that she's thrust back into it again. And she has to live in that world of the imagination, as at the end of Streetcar Named Desire, Blanche does. Remember, she goes out of that play on the arm of a doctor heading for a mental hospital. And in some ways, Tennessee Williams' work was like his Glass Menagerie. It's where he retreated. His father used to call him a sissy. He was a rather brutal, certainly drunken man with no sympathy for his son. And so the young Tennessee Williams, originally with his sister Rose, would retreat into a world of make-believe. As the character says, there are no lies but those thrust down the throat by the hard-knuckled hand of need. There are no lies except those that are necessary. Mm. Blanche lives in a world of fantasy. Could she exist in any other world?
Let's talk with someone else. We have another caller here, line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I, because of the guests that are here, I was very interested in asking about the recent production in New York of Streetcar, which didn't seem to have come off too well, and I saw it, and my view of it was that although Natasha Richardson is a great actress, in a way I think one of the big problems is that Bois was not really an aristocrat in the British sense, but you know, a kind of a grungy aristocrat, and that's a little somebody to capture who's not that familiar with the South. So I was wondering if either of you had seen that and what your view of it. Of course, there was another problem, too, in that the Stanley Kowalski didn't seem to be quite right for the part, and even though he, too, is a good actor. But I was just curious to have your views of that production, if either of you had seen it.
Regrettably not. I've seen all manner of productions of that play, and you're right, the casting is critical, as of course it is in most plays. As to the ability of a British actress to play that part, I'm actually amazed these days by the ability of British actors to play Americans and Americans to play British actors. There was a time when you imagined that was almost impossible. It was a failure of sensibility or understanding, comprehension in some way. You're right, of course, about the nature of the aristocracy, but most of our aristocracy is pretty decaying and decadent as well, so I would have thought that would have actually qualified her for playing this part.
I think I didn't see the production either, although I've read about that one and the other several other recent productions of the major works of Williams. I think it does raise the question about looking at those major works of any playwright, I think one of the things that you have to rise to is the standard of the very notable either original production or filmed versions of plays like this. And very often a production is almost doomed to failure in contrast with those sorts of things. So for myself as a director, that's one of the reasons why I find it's very good to go to these relatively unknown works, because it gives audiences and performers a chance to address the playwright and the playwright's work in a fresh way, and to see something that you don't have to judge against a preconception.
Right. Well, you know, I of course saw the movie version with Vivian Leigh, and I thought she did a splendid job. But you see, she was psychotic, and I think was able to, maybe for that reason, to get the fragility of that character. But it seemed to me that Natasha Richardson was overpoweringly strong there. Naturally, I don't go back far enough. I don't know what Jessica Tandy did with it, but I do think that in a way, It's very hard to, of course, when you play one of these things, you want to get a new interpretation and so on and so forth, but there's always trouble in that.
Right, and often what that means, and it has in I think the recent production of Glass Menagerie that played on Broadway, is to use a novel approach that may twist the play or...
Yeah, and that was even more troublesome, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. That production used... scenographic techniques that sort of, I think, alienated the audience and kept things separate from just the moment of seeing the actors.
Of course, you're right. It's very difficult to get past not only Vivian Leigh, but more significantly Marlon Brando, that really has haunted generations of people. And if people come to that play now, the likelihood is that they've come to it via the movie on DVD.
Hmm. Right.
Well,
thank you.
Thanks for the call. Yes. About 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest, Christopher Bigsby. He's professor of American Studies, director of the Arthur Miller Center, University of East Anglia, and Tom Mitchell. He's associate professor of theater at the University of Illinois. We're talking about Tennessee Williams and have been talking about his play, Candles to the Sun, his first full-length play that was first produced in an amateur production in 1937 and is now being produced again here on the U of I campus for a As far as anybody knows, the first time since it was first produced. One of the things that really struck me in sitting down and reading the play, and I guess it's probably been a while since I've read a play off the page like that, was how little there is in this sense, that what you get, what a playwright gives you, is the lines that the actors speak, perhaps some very minimal stage direction, and that's all. So... that it falls to the director to make an awful lot of decisions about what happens, about who these characters really are and how they should look and how they should move and what else should be on the stage and so much. Where you're, how do you go about divining, if you can, what you think the playwright would have wanted when he's, in this particular case, he's not there to ask. You know, maybe if you're lucky, you're working with a living playwright, you can have the guy sitting there and you can say, well, is this really what you had in mind?
But you have to say that Shakespeare didn't leave us much in the way of stage directions. And there is at the other extreme someone like a Samuel Beckett, you know, who tells you exactly how somebody moves. And if you fail to do that, there is an estate ready to breathe down your neck and insist that you play it as it's written. But I think for the most part, what you're looking for and what a writer is looking for is for that work to be taken over by the director and by the actors and to be represented to you. The last thing they want is a kind of Moscow Arts Museum theater in which we go on for 100 years producing it exactly as it was then, because each generation rediscovers plays and each director and actor does it. I mean, the theater is the only one of the arts that habitually operates in the present tense, and the present tense is our tense. We are there in that moment. And anyone who's been in the theatre knows that they can actually influence what goes on stage. A play can run 10 minutes, 15 minutes longer one night than it does another because of the way the audience has responded. Mm-hmm. And actors pick this up. A couple of decades ago, Margaret Thatcher in England famously said, "There is no such thing as society." It would have been echoed by Ronald Reagan. There is a society, and it's presented in the theatre every night. If it were not, it could not operate that way. The individual actor responds to the actors around them. The members of the audience are aware that they're not there as individuals. They are part of something. So I don't think you're looking in the theatre for a kind of prescriptive model of how a thing must be presented. You're looking for the interpretation that's brought to it by all those people who are involved. Now, if you're a writer, of course, that makes you terribly vulnerable, especially in the first production of a play. A play can be killed for decades by having a poor first production because few critics are able to sort out what is a poor play from what is a poor production of a good play.
Yes. I think one of the things that actually that makes this play work fairly well is that Williams worked very closely with the director of The Mummers, a man named Willard Holland, who, by Williams' account, was a magician working with these amateur performers and working with him as a playwright. Evidently, there are more than 400 pages of revisions and versions of this play because Holland sat down with Williams and they reworked things and developed them in the process of mounting the production. So Williams didn't write this in isolation. He didn't just complete the play, hand it over, and it was done. But it was a work in process between the two of them. One of the things that in this play, I think that's a mark of his youth and his lack of sophistication. The play centers around a lamp that figures in all of the households that are on stage. And at a climactic moment on the in the play, Williams calls for this oil lamp that is to be lit to be smashed on the floor by terrorists who come into the house. Well, I don't know how in this auditorium in St. Louis in 37 they could have possibly smashed an oil lamp on the floor at the climactic moment. The whole place would have burned down. So I'm not sure what they did about that.
His first Broadway play was actually called to a halt by the fact that the smoke that was called for on the stage was so effective it drove everybody out of the theater.
Right. He had a few things to learn.
I've actually got a copy of this, a manuscript copy of this play, where he's scribbled things out and put things in, and mostly to do with expletives. And the surprise to me was that he was actually putting them in rather than taking them out. Though whether they actually reached the stage or not, I don't know, because as you say, there are actually various versions of the play. That's another thing I think people who are not involved in the theatre sometimes don't realise, because once a play is printed, it looks as though that was how it came out. That was the thing itself. Very often these days, what you find printed is the result of the rehearsal process itself. It is the text that was ended up with after that process has gone through, not necessarily the text that they went into it. In fact, sometimes they will publish both, because they would like the text to be available when it opens, but then they can't take the rehearsal changes into account. Then a few months later, they publish the revised version. It is an organic process, and many writers will respond to things that happen during the rehearsal process.
Mm-hmm. We're coming down to the point here where we maybe have about 5 minutes left or so, and I'm continuing to, as you're talking, continuing to think about and reflect on the kinds of things you said about here in the United States, people, their lack of regard, Americans' lack of regard for American drama, and why that should be the case. I don't know, are Americans any more likely to show respect to Shakespeare or some other high British dramatist than they would be to Arthur Miller?
They have an inordinate respect for British drama and for British actors and for British television. We have middle-brow soap opera-y things which come across to this country, then used to have Masterpiece Theatre stamped on the front, and in the old days Alistair Cook would introduce them, and they went from being sort of middle-class, middle-brow soap opera to being high culture by virtue of crossing the Atlantic. There's a certain amount of snobbery that attaches itself to the response to British things. Mm-hmm. But, for example, Eugene O'Neill, one of the great immovable force in American drama, despaired of his final plays being produced in America, he left them to a Swedish theatre to be put. He also said he thought they were too depressing for the Americans, presumably on the ground that the Swedes are already depressed, so you couldn't...
Where's there to go from there? Yeah.
And but he believed that the American sensibility is not attuned to tragedy. You're dedicated to the pursuit of happiness. Can you imagine Germans being dedicated to that? Or the British? I mean, that's an American thing. But that is not compatible with a tragic sensibility. Miller, Williams, O'Neill were writers of tragedies.
Hmm. Do you... I'm interested in hearing from Tom, being someone who works here and works with young people who want to be actors and is a director, how you come up against this apparently, you know, reluctance perhaps some Americans have to be interested in any theater, but particularly in theater created by American playwrights.
Well, I think the good thing about working with students in the theater is that they tend to be in touch with what is being written, and they don't quite have that bias. I think it isn't easy in this country just to stay on top of plays that are coming out and the breadth of things, not just new plays but older works, because they're not published, they don't stay in print for a long time, and they're not in the popular imagination quite so much as other forms. So in my experience, the students I work with have a healthy appreciation of sort of the breadth of material available.
I think the good thing about the American theater in the last decades has been the growth of regional theater. It used to be very New York-oriented, and that meant, as Miller used to complain, there was only one critic who mattered, and that was the critic of the New York Times. Hmm. And the New York Times couldn't keep a play going, but it could certainly close it. It was possible to have the closing announcement pinned up backstage the night the review came out. Now plays tend to open around the country, out in Minneapolis or wherever, or in Chicago, the Goodman. Mm-hmm. And that's a much healthier situation. It's a kind of pluralistic theater. And so I think things have changed. There has been a recovery in the response as well. I think that the power of the New York Times is not what it was. That doesn't happen in Britain. You see, we've got so many national dailies. It doesn't matter if one reviewer trashes a play because there are 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 other nationals, either weeklies or dailies, that will give a different version of it.
Mm. Is a play-going audience in Britain that significant percentage of the British population?
Theatre going audiences in America or in Britain are somewhere between 1 and 2%. But that doesn't mean people are not watching drama. They sit down every night and watch hour after hour of drama on television. They just don't realize they're watching drama. It's actually as essential to you as dreaming, and in fact it's related to dreaming. David Mamet described the theater as the dream life of a nation. You need to dream. It's sleep deprivation is a form of torture, but it's not actually the deprivation of sleep. It's depriving people of dreams. Mm-hmm. Theater is about dreams. It's what gives shape and coherence to the experiences that we have, and that's why the playwright is so vital to us all.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's encouraging if it is the case that at least people have the opportunity to see, more people in more places around the country have the opportunity to see some live theater. And you think back to, you were talking about the day of the federal theater projects. It's like there was actually a federal writers project. The government was actually paying writers and artists and people like that to write and to paint murals and to put on plays.
The federal government was not then regarded as the enemy.
Yes, well, things have changed some since then. It's the old deal now, or the some kind of deal. I don't know what kind of deal it is. Certainly not the deal. We're coming down to the point where we have to finish up. I do want to mention again that for folks here around Champaign-Urbana, if they would like to see Candles to the Sun this weekend, how many performances are you doing this weekend?
Through Sunday afternoon. So there are performances each evening tonight through Saturday, and then Sunday matinee.
All right. And you still have not, Chris, you have not, still not have seen the play?
I'm seeing it tonight.
Well, it should be an interesting experience.
I'm very much looking forward to it.
And then also that our guest here, Christopher Bigsby, will be giving a talk about Tennessee Williams. Tennessee Williams, Radical of the Heart, tomorrow afternoon, 2 o'clock in the Studio Theater on the U of I campus. So again, people are interested in taking that in. They can do that. Well, I certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Maybe just, I just have a second here. I am curious about and invite Chris Bigsby to talk a little bit more about himself, because all the way at the beginning, before we even started, we were sitting here chatting, and I said, so how is it that that someone from England, his thing is American drama? And not only are you interested in Tennessee Williams, but particularly because this place that you're associated with is called the Arthur Miller Center, you're particularly interested in the work of Arthur Miller.
Well, I was explaining, originally it was purely arbitrary. I had done a master's degree on the novel, and I thought, right, that's the novel, now drama. But I got interested just when the American theatre was really exciting. It was in the 1960s. And when I originally started writing, I used to have that kind of critical disdain. I was writing from the mountaintop. I didn't want to dirty my hands by knowing playwrights. Heaven knows, actors. But after a while, I changed that, and I started sitting in on rehearsals. And I realized rehearsals were like graduate seminars, because actors need to know the answers to the questions. They've got to walk out every night in front of hundreds of people. And I found that so exciting to follow. And, of course, because I'm the Arthur Miller Center, the career of Arthur Miller, who, unfortunately, we lost on February the 10th, which was the 56th anniversary to the day of the opening of Death of a Salesman on Broadway.
Yeah. Well, I thank you both very much. Christopher Bigsby is Professor of American Studies and Director of the Arthur Miller Center of the University of East Anglia, and also Tom Mitchell, Associate Professor of Theater here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you very much. Programs here made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Focus 580, the show, also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. And that's it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more in the way of news, features, weather, sports, other things coming up as part of the afternoon magazine. And the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. And I think this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, the interview that we'll do this afternoon will dovetail very nicely with what you've done this morning in the second hour of Focus 580. Julia Kelman will be our guest this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. She holds appointments in the School of Art and Design and the College of Medicine at the University of Illinois. We'll talk with her about what she calls expressive arts and the healing power of narrative. That follows the 1 o'clock news. Taking a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat trading at 344, down 1. March wheat, 357 and a half, down 1 3/4. December corn, 204 and a half, down 1/4. March, 217 and 3/4 unchanged. May, 225 and a half unchanged. December corn, 248 and a half, down 1/4. November soybeans, 570 and a quarter, that up 6 3/4. January, 581 and a half, up 6 and a half. March, 589, up 6 1/4.